From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, December 10, 2008. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill are outraged over reports of inadequate oversight of the $700 billion bailout. We continue our week-long series on human rights and head to Canada and hear about a measure that allows for the indefinite detention of non-citizens. And another Ecuadorian man is violently murdered in New York, sending shockwaves through the immigrant community. I'm Aura Bogado. Stay tuned for that and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. United Electrical workers continue to occupy a Chicago factory that tried to illegally close without paying them. Doug Cunningham from Workers Independent News has the update.
Bank of America cut off financing to Republic Windows and Doors, and the company decided to close the factory with just 3 days' notice, violating the Federal Warren Act. But now the bank says it will extend limited additional credit to the company to help resolve the sit-down. UE organizer Leah Freed says the workers' morale and resolve not to back down is high.
The fight that these workers have taken on is really a fight for all working people, all people who struggle every day to make ends meet and are getting screwed over by their bosses and are getting screwed over by the banks and where the government is failing us.
Negotiations between UE, Bank of America, and the company are underway to resolve the sit-down strike. UE workers and Jobs with Justice rallied today at Bank of America's Chicago headquarters to support the sit-downers and to demand that the bank stop home foreclosures. The UE workers in Chicago have peacefully occupied the Republic Windows and Doors factory for 6 days as they seek roughly $1.5 million owed to the roughly 200 sit-down strikers. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Doug Cunningham.
Greece remains in turmoil today as protests continue over the police killing of a teenage boy last weekend. A general strike has shut down flights, banks, schools, and health facilities. Protesters also threw gasoline bombs outside the court where the two officers accused in the killings appeared. In Zimbabwe, cholera has now claimed the lives of more than 750 people, despite combined efforts to curb the waterborne disease. And the reported deaths and infection rates are likely low because cases in rural areas often go uncounted. In other news from the country, activist groups say human rights workers are being targeted and abducted. Davison Makanga reports from Cape Town, South Africa.
Human rights organizations have slammed persistent violation of rights in Zimbabwe. In a strong statement today, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch called for the release of four human rights campaigners recently abducted by operatives allegedly working for the state. The whereabouts of 15 Movement for Democratic Change activists is also not known 5 weeks after their disappearance. Human Rights Watch Africa researcher Tiseke Kasambala says today's International Human Rights Day commemorations were dampened by the crisis in Zimbabwe.
What has happened now constitutes what we call an enforced disappearance, which means they're being held outside the usual tenets of the law and that they are also therefore in danger of being tortured or worse. And we're really concerned about this.
Meanwhile, opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai says he will not form a unity government with rival Robert Mugabe in the light of fresh crackdown on his supporters. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jefferson Makanga in Cape Town, South Africa.
For the past 3 days, negotiators have met in Beijing to decide on a way for North Korea to verify its nuclear weapons program. But today, the six-party denuclearization talks ended without a deal. Now, further negotiations may have to wait until the start of the Obama administration. FSRN's Jason Strother has more from Seoul.
The main roadblock during this round of negotiations was dirt, but just not any dirt. The U.S. wants North Korea to allow international inspectors to remove soil samples from the Yongbyon reactor in order to verify the country's disclosure about its nuclear weapons program. Analyst Andre Lankov at Seoul's Gukmin University says North Korea has no intention to actually end its nuclear program.
As long as they have nuclear weapons, they can blackmail the world in providing them with aid whenever they need this aid. Plus, they worry about their security and they need it as a way to make sure that they will not be attacked. Plus, they need it for domestic purposes as a powerful piece of propaganda.
The Bush administration had hoped to score a foreign policy success in the six-party talks, but some analysts believe North Korea is awaiting the start of the Obama administration in order to win new concessions. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul, South Korea.
6 years after joining the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, U.K. troops have set a date to withdraw and will start the process in March. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
The UK still has around 4,000 troops in Iraq, although the majority of them are now confined to Basra Air Base in the southern part of the country. According to an unnamed senior defence source quoted by the BBC, total British withdrawal and handover, not to Iraqis but to US troops, will be completed by mid-2009. While a Ministry of Defence spokesperson described Basra as transformed, British military personnel complained they didn't have sufficient resources or troops to defeat criminal gangs and militia groups without US help. Some claimed their continuing deployment was only to save US face for its disastrous policy on Iraq. More British troops and equipment will be deployed to Afghanistan next year. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Democrats in Congress have issued a scathing report calling the Federal Communications Commission dysfunctional and saying Chair Kevin Martin manipulated data to meet his personal policy goals. The report does not say Martin violated any laws, and Republican members of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, the body that issued the report, would not sign off on the findings. The report largely criticized Martin, saying his heavy-handed, opaque, and non-collegial management style has created distrust, suspicion, and turmoil. And across the U.S. today, members of the LGBT community are observing Day Without a Gay. Organizers are calling for people to call in gay instead of sick to work as a symbolic call for equal rights. They want people to instead donate their time to community service. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
The House is expected to vote Wednesday on an auto industry bailout package. The big three automakers originally asked for $34 billion to help them weather the financial crisis, but just two of those, Chrysler and GM, will get about half that amount. Ford says it can do without direct assistance for the time being. The legislation forces company restructuring and authorizes President Bush to nominate a car czar to oversee the bailout. The Senate was to vote on the plan first, but Senate Republicans have held up the vote. As the auto bailout moves forward, Congress is turning its attention back to the other bailout. That's the $700 billion it provided to stabilize the financial sector. Two oversight panels have recently criticized the implementation and management of the program. As Tanya Snyder reports, some lawmakers are outraged that the bailout money isn't getting to the people who need it.
On the heels of a federal report questioning oversight of the federal bailout program, lawmakers on Capitol Hill slammed Treasury officials for not demanding enough transparency from the banks they bail out.
We do not know what banks are doing with their money because Treasury will not tell us.
Carolyn Maloney of New York is concerned that the money isn't reaching consumers.
But the press tells us that they're buying highways in Europe, that they are buying other banks, or that they're holding on to the money. What my constituents tell me is they cannot have access to capital. We have put $7.8 trillion of taxpayers' money out there for the purpose of creating credit, and it has been a dismal failure.
Maloney says that with all the money banks have received, they still haven't loosened up credit enough so that people can buy cars and homes. In the last few weeks, the auto industry has asked Congress for a loan that amounts to a fraction of the money the financial sector has received. The auto companies have faced intense scrutiny over their business practices, their recovery plan, their fuel efficiency, and even the executives' mode of transportation. Republican Thaddeus McCotter represents the Detroit metro area. He's sensitive to the double standard for Wall Street. He wants the banks to have to answer to the committee, too.
As we continue to go through this process, we see no one, a CEO, or anyone from the financial institutions that have to date received hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayer money. And I hope that in the future we can correct that. I don't care if they take a yacht. I don't care if they hitchhike.
Neil Kashkari runs the bailout program for Treasury. He defended the oversight mechanisms.
We first moved immediately to establish the Financial Stability Oversight Board. The board has already met 5 times in the 2 months since the law was signed, with numerous staff calls between meetings.
The law also required a special inspector general to oversee the bailout, and the Senate just confirmed Neil Barofsky in that position on Monday.
In the interim, pending his confirmation, We've been coordinating closely with Treasury's Inspector General. We have had numerous briefings with GAO, and our respective staffs meet or speak on an almost daily basis to update them on the program and review contracts.
Not everybody was convinced.
It doesn't feel good. These footprints on my back are just too tough.
Maxine Waters of California pointed to a case in Chicago where workers are forced to fight not just against their company, but against the bank that finances the company.
You have poor workers who are sitting in at Republic Windows and Doors factory because Bank of America, that we gave $15 billion in TARP funds, refused a line of credit and to follow through on his commitment to finance the company.
Waters asked Kashkari if he had stepped in to ask Bank of America to reconsider their actions. Kashkari responded that it wasn't appropriate for him to comment. With all this concern about where the money's going, students are also worried that some bad actors might be getting a piece of the pie. The Treasury Department has said that private student loan companies are eligible for bailout money. Rich Williams works on the higher education project of U.S. PIRG.
We're really concerned about the potential of federal money being used to bail out non-federal student loan programs. Unlike the federal program, this private student loan companies offer the worst rates to the lowest income students, the students who are the most needy.
Lawmakers have suggested evaluation panels and further legislation to ensure better oversight of the bailout. It is still unclear what, if anything, will be done. For FSRN, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
A piece of legislation pending in the House would make changes to the National Labor Relations Act to make it easier for unions to organize workers. The Employee Free Choice Act was originally co-sponsored by then-Senator Barack Obama, but fared a tough time on Capitol Hill. The act is expected to be revisited by lawmakers when they return to Washington next year. Faith Colberth is president of SEIU Security Officers United in Los Angeles and led a long effort to unionize some 4,000 security officers in L.A.
What this act would ensure is that an employee would have the choice to join a union. In this country now, with the old labor laws that currently exist, 25% of employers who have employees that attempt to form a union fire, harass, or shut down work sites of those unions. We can just look at Walmart as an example of employees who have over and over again demanded a union and the employer having the option to do whatever is necessary to make sure that that doesn't happen. And what the Employee Free Choice Act does is exactly what it says. It gives the employee the free choice to say, I want to join a union without harassment, without intimidation, without being fired.
The Employee Free Choice Act, or EFCA, faces tough opposition from many employers, including McDonald's, which employs some 465,000 people. The fast food giant is organizing franchise owners to fight against EFCA, urging them to contact their representatives and senators to oppose the act. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is pledging to spend $10 million to defeat the legislation, while right-wing pundits call EFCA anti-democratic for the workplace because it would take away the secret union ballot vote. The Free Choice Act would replace the secret ballot with a card workers can sign to join the union. Colberth explains.
Nothing can be more democratic than the majority of the workers at a work site saying we want to join a union. What ends up happening with the secret ballot election is you end up putting the employee against their employer. The conversation becomes completely different when the option is being made in an environment where, in most corporate environments and in most work sites, it's not proactive for your job to say, I want to be in a union. And that's what we're attempting to change. That secret ballot election, what that does is it presents the image that you have a choice between the union and your employer versus actually what this does is allow the employee to say, you know what, I want to be in a union in order to be better at my job. And so that's the big difference. In no way, shape, or form does this deny democracy. It actually promotes democracy. It's democracy in its purest form. That's my opinion.
Faith Colberth is president of SEIU Security Officers United in Los Angeles. The new Congress is expected to take up EFCA early next year. You're listening to FSRN. This week marks a pivotal moment for death row inmate Troy Davis, who sits on death row for the 1989 killing of Savannah police officer Mark McPhail. Davis has endured three last-minute stays of execution since July 2007, after his lawyers and activists campaigned for a retrial to present evidence of his innocence. FSRN Sacagawea Hall was at the Georgia court yesterday, which held a hearing that many think is Davis's last chance.
Supporters of Troy Davis showed up in big numbers Tuesday, packing the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Georgia. While the panel of three judges challenged both sides with tough questions, their decision will be based on Davis's ability to meet two criteria. Amnesty International's Southern Region's Deputy Director, Laura Moy, describes the criteria Davis must meet.
To meet their criteria to get the second federal habeas petition granted, he has to prove that there is compelling evidence today that if a reasonable jury heard that today, would not convict him. The second thing, though, that's more difficult is he has to prove that he was diligent in presenting this information in a timely fashion.
In addition to these criteria, Moy believes there is another important question.
If they believe that Troy could have presented this new evidence earlier, that he wasn't diligent, there's an interesting second question, and that is, well, if he can meet the first criteria, that yes, a reasonable jury today, looking at the information today, would not sentence him to death, is it okay to execute him?
While there were two sets of criteria, a substantial amount of time was spent on the first, the actual evidence. Evidence against Davis at the time of the trial relied heavily on witness testimony. Davis's lawyers reminded the court that seven of the nine witnesses in the case recanted or changed their testimony. They argue these seven witnesses, along with three new witnesses, provide compelling evidence for Davis's innocence. Georgia State Attorney claimed there is no credible evidence to support Davis's actual innocence and defended the case built against him. The court posed a question, which Davis's sister agrees is critical to her brother's appeal.
Like the judges said, okay, if you take away this evidence, what do you have against Troy? And that is the question. And that should be enough reasonable doubt, you know? They're not saying for factual Troy is innocent. They're saying without this, what do you have? And should this give him a time in court? And I'm praying that their answer will be yes, we need to give some relief.
Officer Mark McPhail's family was also present in court. Afterward, his mother described her feelings during the hearing.
Because you want to do and say something, and there are certain things that are said that are not quite true, in my opinion. And that's frustrating.
The McPhail family said they had no doubt in their minds that Davis is guilty and wanted to finally see an end. An end is not yet in sight, without knowing when the court will actually present their decision. An unfavorable decision for Troy Davis would mean the state of Georgia scheduling another execution date. If the decision is in favor of Davis, it could lead to an evidentiary hearing and possibly a new trial. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sacagawea Hall.
Two violent attacks of Ecuadorian men in New York are sending shockwaves through immigrant communities. Tuesday night, Jose Sacuzané was pronounced brain dead after he and his brother were brutally attacked by four men as they shouted anti-immigrant and anti-gay slurs. This comes 1 month after the murder of Marcelo Lucero, a 37-year-old Ecuadorian immigrant who was stabbed to death by a gang of teenagers at a train station in Patchogue, Long Island. Lucero's and Sacuzané's murders have reignited the debate around violence against immigrant workers from Latin America. FSRN's Christopher Rios reports from New York.
Jose Sacuzané lived in the United States for 10 years and after waiting tables started a family-run real estate business in Brooklyn. On Sunday, as he was walking home from a bar with his brother, Romel, an SUV pulled up and three black men inside started yelling racist and anti-gay slurs. The attackers beat Jose with a bottle and a baseball bat. He's now brain dead and on life support. Police haven't made any arrests. A month ago, a group of white and black teens stabbed another Ecuadorian immigrant to death in Long Island. Marcelo Lucero lived in the United States for 16 years, working recently as a dry cleaner. Of the seven teenagers involved in the attack, only one, Jeffrey Conroy, the attacker who allegedly stabbed Lucero, was indicted with murder as a hate crime. The other teenagers were indicted with varying offenses, including gang assault, conspiracy, attempted assault, and attempted gang assault. Conroy, who faces upgraded charges of second-degree murder as a hate crime, can be sentenced to 25 years to life in prison. Lucero's death has brought to light a long list of hate crimes in Suffolk County, where victims of hate crimes have been speaking out. Arturo Bilchis is with the United Day Laborers of Long Island.
This place has a long history of racial hatred. On July 4, 2005, a group of white supremacists had decided to celebrate the independence of the United States by burning an entire immigrant family inside of their home. On that midnight, they'd set fire to the house, but fortunately, by the hand of God, the neighbors came to the family's aid, and this violation was not accomplished. The family was able to escape alive through the windows. I can't keep count of the racist actions that Latino immigrants experience in Suffolk, and we haven't done anything against these racial actions, and still we try to keep living in peace.
Patrick Young of the Central American Refugee Center on Long Island explains the current anti-immigrant atmosphere in Suffolk County.
The problem is that Suffolk County, really for the last 5 years, has actively discouraged Latinos from reporting hate crimes. They've set up structures where Latinos are essentially alienated from the police system, and where they have reported bias-related attacks, the county government has not investigated them or listed them as hate crimes.
FBI hate crime statistics released last month show a rise of attacks on Latinos across the country. Jan Amaya is a legal staff attorney with the Mexican American Legal Defense Education Fund.
If you look at the FBI hate crime statistics, you'll see that since 2003, hate crimes against Hispanics has risen to nearly 40%. And what we're trying to say is it can't be just mere coincidence that over that same time period, you've had over 300 anti-immigrant or nativist organizations that have been created.
Although the FBI hate crime statistics highlight an alarming trend in bias attacks against Latinos, some say the number of hate crimes are much higher. Again, John Amaya.
Part of the problem is that there's no mandate for state and local entities to either identify crimes as hate crimes nationally or to report them to federal authorities. There are a lot of individuals who are terrified of law enforcement, and they just do not report crimes, even when they've been assaulted, even when they've been left for dead. We've dealt with cases where individuals were brutally assaulted and they were terrified of going forward because of the backlash, not just to them, but to their family. And in some cases, they're afraid of deportation. They're afraid of their immigration status coming into play. And so they refuse medical attention, and they refuse to come forward and speak with authorities.
Amaya and the Mexican American Legal Defense Education Fund have launched a campaign, Truth in Immigration, to address inaccuracies on immigration in America. But Patrick Young thinks more needs to be done by local and state governments to prevent future biased attacks.
Long Island really represents the changing vision of the American suburb. And as we can see, in Nassau County, the county government is recognizing that and is trying to reach out to the immigrant community. Unfortunately, Suffolk's experience is very similar to what we're seeing in many other suburbs around the United States, where rather than understanding the change and trying to work with the newcomers into the community, there's an attempt to drive the newcomers out. And that's why the Long Island experience and the struggle really around Marcelo Lucero's death is an important symbolic struggle for all immigrants and all Latinos in the United States.
As the Lucero family and the Latino community await the trial date for the teens, last week the Congregational Church of Patchogue reached out to the Latino community, inviting hate crime victims to tell their stories in a safe environment. Reporting for FSRN, I'm Christopher Rios with Jose Gomez from the Community News Production Institute.
We continue our week-long series today marking the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by traveling to Montreal, Canada. Court proceedings got underway again on Tuesday for Adil Charkawi, who's the target of Canada's controversial security certificates. That's a measure which allows the government to indefinitely detain non-citizens without charge, due process, or the right to see evidence against them. The possible outcome of this month's hearings is that Charkawi could be deported to his native Morocco. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has more from Montreal.
December the 10th is celebrated around the world as International Human Rights Day, and Canada joins in the festivities, often touting what is seen as its proud human rights record at home and abroad. However, today, Canadians in many cities around the country are voicing their outrage against what they see are in fact gross human rights violations by the Canadian government. Deportations and renditions to torture, secret trials, and security certificates. At the center of this debate is Adil Sharkawi, who is undergoing proceedings at the federal court in Montreal this week. Sharkawi, a 34-year-old permanent resident and father of three, has been in Canada since 1995. He was detained at a jail in Montreal from 2003 to 2005 under a security certificate, with vague allegations handed down from the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service, or CSIS, about his connections to terrorism. He was never charged under Canada's criminal code and never tried. Anna Mala, who works with the Coalition for Justice for Adil Sharkawi, is calling this week's court proceedings a show trial.
We refuse to call any of this hearings or anything to do with any kind of real legal process because it's really not. First of all, there's never been any actual allegations or accusations about Adil. It's been all the vague sort of statement of we have reasonable grounds to believe that this person may have been, may be, or may at some time pose a threat to national security, national security being undefined. And what's happening this coming week is basically we're calling it a show trial because there's been no evidence presented.
In early 2007, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled the security certificates unconstitutional and gave the government 1 year to create a new law. Prime Minister Stephen Harper came back with new security certificate legislation entitled Bill C-3. Critics say Bill C-3 largely resembles the old legislation, save for a new measure called Special Advocates. Advocates who are supposed to defend the accused, who have access to the evidence, but cannot communicate that evidence to their defendant. However, Sharkawi thinks that the special advocates are far from granting him any real protection.
It's somebody who has secret clearance to see secret evidence. This special advocate, I cannot really choose him. He has been chosen by CSIS, the government, and they offer me a list, and they have to select some names, and it's the judge who will finally reject or approve those names.
Sharkawi's case was back at the Supreme Court in Ottawa in June of this year, when the court ruled that CSIS had in fact destroyed evidence in his file, and that the presentation of summary reports in the place of real evidence was unacceptable. Warren Almond is the former Solicitor General of Canada and the current chair of the International Civil Liberties Monitoring Group.
To have people put in prison to lose their liberties and their rights of security of person on the basis of evidence that's not subject to cross-examination, to testing, that is, and there's a record of mistakes being made in the past, is really contrary to the principles of democratic society and a society where we have a charter of rights and freedoms.
Court proceedings for the Sharkawi case continue through this week. If the federal court deems that the security certificate is reasonable, he could be deported back to Morocco in the coming few months. Two risk assessments carried out by Immigration Canada in 2003 and 2007 have found that Sharkawi would likely face torture, death, or cruel and unusual punishment if he is deported to Morocco. Meanwhile, Sharkawi and his lawyers plan on presenting a constitutional challenge to Bill C-3 at the Supreme Court, and his supporters plan on maintaining a constant presence at the federal court this week. From Montreal, this is Aaron Lakoff reporting for FSRN.
And that will do it for today's newscast. From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.